Salt Peanuts is one of Bebop's classic songs. It was a collaboration between Dizzy Gillespie and Kansas City's own Charlie Parker, a collaboration that was born here in Kansas City at the Black Musicians Union, near 18th and Vine. That's according to Chuck Haddix, who you probably know as the host of the Fish Fry here on KCUR.
1940, Cab Calloway was in town, and Step Buddy Anderson introduced Bird and Dizzy Gillespie, and they went around the corner upstairs at 627, and that was the rehearsal hall up there. And Charlie and Step Buddy played for Dizzy, and Dizzy played the piano, and that's when they first met. You might say Bebop was born right upstairs at the foundation. The name of it is Salt Peanuts.
Kansas City may not be widely regarded as the official birthplace of Bebop, but Charlie Parker, known as Bird, earned his chops here. By the early 1940s, New York was the center of the jazz universe. Even Parker himself had fled to the Big Apple by then. But still, as we embrace Charlie Parker as our own with a week-long birthday celebration in his honor starting tonight, maybe we can take a little credit for Bebop? I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we'll be chatting with a Bebop scholar making a pilgrimage to our fair city, Scott DeVoe, jazz historian from the University of Virginia and author of The Birth of Bebop. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much.
How would you say that Kansas City figures into the story of Bebop, with Charlie Parker being one of the Bebop pioneers? Could you say the Kansas City influence is audible in this style
of
music?
Yeah, I would. I mean, there's a sense in which the New York is where it had to have happened. Charlie Parker is at least half of Bebop, and I think that there are many ways in which even Dizzy Gillespie would have to kind of doff his cap and say, in many ways, the way of playing, the way of getting from note to note, which is kind of musician talk for techniques of phrasing and so forth, come from Charlie Parker. And he's definitely a Kansas City person. I mean, Kansas City has a rich enough jazz tradition before him, but he's the one who combines aspects of the local scene, like the local blues scene, in a way that I think makes Bebop what it is. If it had just been Dizzy Gillespie, I think it would have been a different music.
Before we get too carried away talking about the characters and who influenced what, just what is Bebop, if you had to encapsulate it?
Bebop is the beginning of what we think of as modern jazz. And in many ways, I mean, jazz as a general term goes all the way back to the beginning of the 20th century. But there's a sense in which the earlier forms of jazz, like New Orleans jazz and swing, are not exactly what most people these days understand as jazz.
Why not?
Because there's a way in which jazz becomes more modern when it moves into a small group setting.
Away from the big orchestras?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in some ways, those two things were existing side by side because not that most people would have known that, but a lot of these musicians would disappear after their gig into clubs where they would do jam sessions where they had a chance to really work out their stuff in a small group setting. And in some ways, what happened with Bebop is that for various reasons, that jam session style became the norm for jazz. And it still is. It still is the kind of music that when you go into a club, you feel like you're kind of happen to stumble into somebody's living room and they're playing for themselves and they're happy to have you there, but they're not playing for you exactly.
That is something that you wrote about in The Birth of Bebop that really interests me, that this marks kind of a separation between the audience and the performer, in the sense that the performer, the mentality is no longer that the performer is there to satisfy the expectations of a listener.
Yeah, the idea of the jam session is that they're there, you know, they're having fun. They know that it's good music, and they're certainly aware that there are plenty of people out there who are listening to it, but they are not playing to the audience. It's like the general sense of the musicians is inward directed. And in fact, if you think of a jazz group, they're all kind of listening to each other and looking at each other, and they're not like standing there smiling at you while they're doing things. Well, you can't really smile while playing a saxophone or trumpet anyway. It's meant to be, it's kind of hard to say. Some people would say it's more like chamber music, which I guess is true. The reality for these jazz musicians is that this is, in a strange way, their folk tradition, although it's a professional folk tradition. And ultimately, the image, I think that most people have of jazz is, for example, Miles Davis playing a solo and then just kind of walking off, chatting with the musicians. He's not interested in the applause. He's just kind of part of that scene, and you just kind of feel cool for having been there when that happened.
Musically, though, like for someone who isn't really immersed in jazz and might not know a lot of musical terminology, is there a way of summarizing what you would hear in the music that makes it bebop?
Yeah, I teach a history of jazz class, so of course I have this question all the time. And in some ways, I would say the first thing to listen to is the rhythm section. In a dance band, it's there to provide a beat. Doom, boom, boom. And it's like the bass and the bass drum and everything is reinforcing that sense of a beat because they're playing in very large places. So they had to do it at a real, I mean, people talk about being able to hear that boom, 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 you know, outside the hall. You could just feel that kind of vibration. It's a lot like dance music these days. If you go into a, if you come near a place, you're just going to kind of hear that sort of bass oriented woomph coming out from the
very rhythm driven.
Very rhythm driven in a way that doesn't satisfy you until you get inside and you say, okay, that's what it's involved in. But yeah, you hear that sense of rhythm. In the jam session setting, every musician is free to experiment on their own instruments. And in some ways, the first instrument that starts to get involved with this is the drum set. They start realizing that they don't have to just kind of go boom, boom, boom. They realize that they can use the bass drum for accents and they can lighten up the beat and put it on the cymbal. This all comes from a gentleman named Kenny Clark, who actually was from Pittsburgh, which is where I went to high school. So I'm just,
so you're going to claim a little bit of
course,
it, too.
Of course,
as long as we're all claiming our piece.
Yeah, you know, Pittsburgh has its own peculiar jazz scene. It's not like Kansas City's, but still. Kenny Clark came up with this idea, and he actually ended up getting fired from that band because the other musicians didn't like it, that he wasn't reinforcing things.
What is that weird thing you're doing?
What is that weird thing you're doing? And Teddy Hill just said, I'm sorry, man, I have to let you go. Teddy Hill's band then collapsed shortly thereafter, and he ended up becoming the music director at a small club called Minton's Playhouse. And he just suddenly thought, oh, I should really give Kenny a call because... And he said, you know, here you can do all that stuff. You can do all those boom bams and klook mops and things like that. So Kenny Clark in some ways opened up the drum set. And it just kind of spurred a sense that there is a kind of rhythmic evolution that you can have with the small combo that you can't in a big band. And that kind of experimentation just ended up mutating into a new style of jazz.
I love you pepper your book, The Birth of Bebop, with quotes from a lot of people, but Ralph Ellison is kind of a recurring source, and he says that the bebop is a most inadequate word that throws up its hands in clownish self-deprecation.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's an onomatopoeic thing. It's just saying it sounds like bebop. I mean, it was also called rebop and other things of that sort. And there was a Dizzy Gillespie tune that was just called bebop. And I just think it was, the tune just went, ba-doo-dop and doo-dop and doo-dop and doo-dop and bebop, doo-doo-doo. And I just think that doo-doop, that kind of thing, you would just use something like bebop to be able to say it. It's not exactly like the music was demanding a name for itself, but when people started to hear it, I think people like Leonard Feather, who was on the scene as a journalist, just caught on to that and sort of made that. Actually, rebop, as I say earlier, I mean, nobody calls it rebop these days, but that's just another one of the things out there.
Tell me a little bit about yourself and what drew you to the study of jazz generally, and bebop more specifically.
Well, I wasn't a jazz fan from an early age. I only really discovered it in college. I mean, I have friends who tell me about going to see John Coltrane at the Village Vanguard at age 12. I wasn't that kind of kid. But I just discovered it in college, and I just said, yeah, this is what I want to do with my academic life. in the case of bebop, I was always interested in the beginnings of things and thought that I would probably be doing something about the beginnings of jazz in New Orleans or in ragtime or whatever. But then when I started, actually I first heard a recording featuring saxophonist Coleman Hawkins, who was playing with a trumpet player named Howard McGee, and I just listened to it and said, gosh, that sounds like the beginnings of bebop. And so I just became fascinated with the question of when did jazz as we know it start, and how did that happen? And that led me to all kinds of stuff, including getting to know Charlie Parker, you know, very well as a musician.
Yeah, and of course, we are going to talk more about Charlie Parker in a second, but just a last couple of things about the origins of bebop more generally. Mm-hmm. You write about this conflict between bebop as just one phase in the long history of jazz, which starts before bebop and continues beyond it, and this other idea that bebop was truly a revolution, which would make it very much its own thing, like without precedent. Can you talk about this as evolution versus revolution? What's the real conflict there?
Well, Charlie Parker, in fact, once said that, you know, bop has, you know, no relationship to jazz, and just said it's its own thing. And I think at the time he said it, even, there was, I think, enough of a sense that among the people interested in jazz generally had taken that word, which at that time had kind of gone out of fashion. It was the word that was used in the 1920s. For things like the original Dixieland Jazz Band and Paul Whiteman and things like that, and had decided to make that the label because they were connecting jazz to swing. And once they got to bebop, they just said, okay, all this is part of jazz. And even at that point, Dizzy Gillespie said, no, actually, you got to understand it really is all part of this broader spectrum. It's kind of a choice that you make. It could easily have simply been known as bop and become a completely new kind of music. But in the long run, I think these people who are interested in these various kinds of what we now think of as jazz decided it would be better to think of it as a historical tradition. And so, and in some ways, as I say, what people now think of as jazz is essentially a bebop-based rather than New Orleans jazz-based.
You write about World War II and a 1942 ban on recording mm-hmm. as two historical events that really shaped bebop. Can you explain those influences? And then we'll get right to Charlie Parker.
Sure. Well, World War II obviously was big for a lot of people. In this country, it just really shook up the entertainment industry. It shook up the black community, black men were being asked to fight in a war that they had fought in World War I and felt that they were not, after the war, accorded much respect for that. So there was a good deal more skepticism about it in the black community. It's just a lot of stuff on the ground that was happening that kind of stirred things up. The recording ban is a very peculiar thing that has to do with the fact that the Musicians Union was one of the strongest unions in the country, and they decided to fight against the use of recordings on jukeboxes by simply saying, we're not going to make any more records until you come up with some funding for unemployed musicians. And they got everybody to do this. So there were no recordings made except for some recordings made for overseas for the armed services.
During what time period? I mean,
this
how long
like
are we talking
August
about?
August 1942 until, I think, November of 43.
So that's a long time for musicians to be developing and performing without people having access to that through recordings.
Well, it's also a question of what you're actually going to hear of what musicians are doing. I would say that most of the stuff that I was talking about with jam sessions is never going to be recorded, except by occasionally people who have portable disc recorders and come into those nightclubs. It's going to be a question of when somebody wants to make a record of it. So actually during the war as well, one of the problems was that shellac, which the discs at that time were made from, came from Indonesia, which was not very accessible during the Japanese invasion of most of the South Pacific. So they kind of couldn't make as many records anyway. And some of the records they made, they said, were like very flimsy, or they felt like they were made of cardboard or something like that. So in some senses, I'm not sure that that particular band prevented people from hearing things. The more important thing is that the one record company that gave in was Decca. Decca was the one record, major record company that did not have a radio network behind it, as opposed to Columbia and Victor, which had NBC and CBS. So they settled, and then they more or less said, any other record company who wants to settle can do that. Columbia and Victor stayed out for another 8 or 9 months. But in the meantime, all these small record companies said, yeah, yeah, me too. And there were, and they, one of the big areas there were people interested in hot jazz, or in other words, this sort of jam session style thing. And the fact is, most of those musicians did not have any previous contracts with you know, any of the big labels, so they were perfectly willing to make as many recordings as they could, because frankly, they were only earning what you get in a recording session, just your standard session fees. So they were happy to make records, and in some ways, that more than anything produced the kind of atmosphere that helped to spur this stuff to come out of jam sessions and into the general public.
Tell me about Charlie Parker's contributions to bebop. Kansas City has a really a lot of fondness around this narrative, and I'm wondering what it sounds like from someone who doesn't live here.
Well, I would say that it's one of the major jazz regions from the 20s on forward, and there I certainly know a lot about the Territory bands and about Count Basie and Jay McShann and Benny Moten and people like that. There is a sense that there is a jazz scene here that is very strong, and Charlie Parker is kind of the, you know, the flower that comes out of this. He learns a style of improvising that is remarkably quick and absolutely sure harmonically, and he learns how to play the blues.
Let's listen to a track you directed us to where you have the rare opportunity to hear Charlie Parker speaking.
Oh, yeah.
I want to play Slim's Jam. Anything we need to know about this track before hearing it?
Well, Slim was an entertainer as well as a musician. So this is, I mean, you hear him kind of playing with his jazz rhetoric, you know, like Daz McSkibbins, Bouts-a-Rooney, that kind of thing. But you also get to hear Charlie Parker speak. And it's interesting because here he's hanging out with musicians and you hear him talking in a way that probably is the way he would talk when he's among his own folk. He did sound much more, what we would say is conventional radio speak when he was doing an interview with a white person. So I enjoy it for that. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. And it's just great to hear him playing blues in this or bluesy stuff in this context and hear everybody reacting to it.
Let's hear Slim's Jam.
Sure. Yeah.
Say, you better bring me a double order of Riti Bootis with a little hot sauce on it. That'll just about fix it. Well, here's it. Well, look at Charlie Yardboy to Rooney.
Yes, now how's it going, John?
Oh, everything is mellow, man. Look at this. Get his horn with me.
Yeah,
blow
I got
some.
My horn with me, man. I want to blow some, too.
Yeah.
I'm having a little reed trouble.
Haven't got a reed?
Yeah.
Well, Mac Boucher's got a reed. He can trim it down a little. That's great.
Yeah,
okay. Well, that's great. Solid, then. Well, let's get together and blow. We need flat. Take the next one. You got it.
Okay.
All right.
I love those little punctuations, you know, the...
Yeah. That kind of stuff. No, I know. It just kind of gives you a sense of how deeply he connected, even though he's also playing stuff after that that's really very complicated. Or rather, it's just difficult to play.
You write about it being hard to make generalizations about the pioneers of bebop for a lot of reasons, but you use Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie as kind of a study in contrast. Within this contrast, what does Charlie Parker represent? I mean,
he represents, in some ways, the more intuitive side of being a musician. And, you know, intuition is one of those words that can be a code word in jazz for somebody who doesn't really know his music theory. I mean, yeah, that may be true, but I mean, there people who know jazz know that there are some people who can just listen to a chord progression and go, yeah, I got it. And Charlie Parker was one of those people. he also brings with him this incredible bluesy sense that he knows when he's got an audience that wants to hear that. In fact, he once when he was with one of these sort of bebop big bands that was started in like 44, 45, like the Billy Eckstein band, they would be playing gigs down south, and they'd just kind of go, "You know what you're doing?" And he goes, "Yeah, I'm just going to play some of that red beans and rice music." He just knew exactly how to deliver that stuff when he wanted to. At the same time, though, I mean, he's just got a command of the instrument that just made people, they just couldn't really quite believe what they were hearing. It's now become pretty ordinary for jazz musicians to do it. But even after listening to, 75 years of, musicians following this stuff, it still sounds pretty fresh today.
I want to listen to a little more Charlie Parker music. Mm-hmm. We're going to play Now's the Time. If people are listening for some of the characteristics of bebop you mentioned earlier, can you give a little guidance on exactly what they might pick up on when we play this track?
Okay, one reason I like this, it comes from 1953, which means it's late for Charlie Parker, and it's in a good recording studio. This is Norman Granz's Verve Records, and you can really hear Max Roach on drums. And that, to me, is really crucial for being able to kind of hear that interaction between what the drummer is doing, what the saxophonist is doing, and just feeling the whole group gel together. It's also interesting just because it's just Charlie Parker doing, I think, 5 blues choruses in a row. It's a lot of Charlie Parker, and that's just giving him the time to actually do what he wanted to do.
Let's hear Now's the Time by Charlie Parker. Charlie Parker's story ends pretty tragically. It involves, addiction, drug overdose. Is this something that you would consider separate from the history of the music, or are the two inseparable?
It's Charlie Parker became addicted at a pretty young age and before the heroin epidemic in New York in the 1940s. In fact, he was kind of a forerunner of it. And I think a lot of people looked at him and just said, geez, if the guy's playing like that, maybe I ought to do everything that he did. And I know Charlie Parker did not want people to do that, but it just kind of stuck with him. And yes, he did wear himself down. I wouldn't say a drug overdose, but I would say he just wore his body down. I mean, there's a famous story that in the place where he died, which was the apartment of the Baroness Nika de Koenigswalder, that the coroner who came, yeah, that's another story. The coroner who came, just looking at him, estimated his age as 55.
And he was what, 34?
34, yeah. I mean, that just gives you an idea of just how much he had run his body down. And he didn't look very good in those last couple of years. But, I mean, it's just strange to think of that as being late Charlie Parker, but he would have been 95, I guess, if he could still be alive today. It is one kind of story. It's a kind of, lost musician kind of story, or it can be tying jazz to the drug scene and other things like that. It took jazz, quite a while to get over those kinds of connotations. I just think it's interesting to compare that with Dizzy Gillespie, who was not a drug user and had a long career and was a much more organized person, but who didn't have the bluesiness that Charlie Parker had and didn't have that kind of spontaneity.
What do you mean by bluesiness?
He knew what the blues was, and he knew how to play it. He actually modernized the blues. There's a sense in which now blues musicians, guitarists, and so forth know how to play a lot more notes because they've listened to Charlie Parker. He turned it into a more modern idiom, and the blues is constantly evolving anyway.
What is it about Charlie Parker's story that you think we should be carrying forward?
he's just one of the great musicians of the 20th century. If anything, you know, Kansas City, I'm sure, has lots to be proud of. But musically speaking, I would think being the birthplace of Charlie Parker is enough. He's just that important.
Scott DeVoe, thanks so much for talking with me today. We're going to let Charlie Parker take us out.
Okay.
As part of Kansas City's Charlie Parker Birthday Fanfare, Scott DeVoe will be part of a panel discussion this evening at the American Jazz Museum, along with KCUR's own Chuck Haddix, host of The Fish Fry. Chuck Haddix will also lead a bus tour of Charlie Parker's sites in Kansas City this Saturday at 3. When Central Standard returns, two sisters sing the blues, but not together. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned.